Good morning, Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday. It's January 23rd. Currently, we've got 5 degrees here in Old Town Park City, and Heber City reporting 6 degrees. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Yeah, good morning, Wasatch back. Park City, big weekend for you. We have, again, obviously the frigid cold temperatures to kick off today. We are staying below freezing this afternoon as well, just 26 for the high with sunshine. Changes do move in this weekend. We have a little bit of snow in the forecast. We'll see increasing cloud cover tomorrow. Overnight lows still frigid, but not quite as cold. We're expecting teens for overnight lows, about 12, in fact, for Park City. 35 for the high tomorrow. We should start to see some moisture increase to where we'll see some snowflakes tomorrow afternoon, but they'll increase into Saturday. Looking at snow showers off and on Saturday with a few lingering snow showers even into Sunday. It sounds pretty impressive. Unfortunately, snow totals aren't looking super impressive. We're looking at hopefully a couple of inches of snow for the Wasatch back. Temperature-wise, we drop from 35 Friday afternoon to 25 on Saturday for the high, and then 27 on Sunday. Cold air remains in place into next week with temperatures back down into the single-digit territory on Sunday morning. For our ski resorts, we're hoping for, again, a good 2 to 4 inches of snow for a lot of the mountain areas. The upper Cottonwoods might see a little more. Dry weather starts to move back in after those snow showers this weekend. Monday, we'll see 32 for the high, 34 on Tuesday, and then 36 on Wednesday. So a gradual incline with our temperatures with sunshine into next week. Overnight lows will be back in the teens on Wednesday morning as well, about 14 degrees for the overnight low. Heber looking at upper 20s today, 38 tomorrow, dropping back down to 29 on Saturday. Snow showers again increasing tomorrow evening with a chance of snow off and on Saturday, hoping for a couple of inches in Heber Valley as well. 33 for the high Sunday, 35 on Monday. We're back to almost 40 degrees by middle of next week in the Heber Valley as high pressure takes back over. Overnight lows should be right around 13 by Wednesday morning.
Okay, Nate, thanks. On the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, we've got Drew. Good morning, Drew.
Good morning, Leslie. Sorry to be a touch late here. We do have areas of moderate danger at the mid and upper elevations for stiff and stubborn wind slabs. The winds have been fairly relentless the last 72 hours. They have dropped off a bit, you know, along the higher ridge lines. They're now about 10 to 20 miles an hour, but the damage is done. The skiing and riding conditions have certainly taken a hit, but it's primarily the wind slabs, and they're hard wind slabs. They have this nasty habit, Leslie, of allowing you to get well onto the lens, the slab itself, before they fracture and break above you generally. They are more stubborn to trigger. They're not sensitive. They're certainly not hair trigger, but they're a bit more devious in that way, that they allow you to get well onto the slab. They're littered all across the compass at the mid and upper elevations. And so we'll just continue to warn of a moderate danger for these wind slabs. I would expect they'll settle out probably in the next 24 to 36 hours. We're still keeping the PWL, the old weak faceted snow, on the radar, but they are becoming more dormant. And I expect that we're going to be trending towards low danger in the coming days. You know, the storm that is quote-unquote on track for the weekend is going to be difficult to forecast. If pressed, I'd say that maybe the Park City Mountains or the Wasatch Back may benefit the most for that. But these cutoff lows are challenging to forecast and all. So, again, bottom line, overall moderate danger for primarily wind slabs across the compass at the mid and upper elevations.
Okay, Drew, thanks so much.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Council member Megan McKenna. Later on, Park City Board of Education members Meredith Reed and Nick Hill will be in to discuss Tuesday's meeting. And finally, from the Swanner Eco Center, the Director of Visitor Experiences and Exhibits, Hunter Klingensmith, with details on the new exhibit, as well as some of the other happenings taking place this winter at the Swanner Eco Center. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include award-winning environmental journalist Marco Vischer, talking about the rise, fall, and return of our mightiest, most feared, and most misunderstood energy source, nuclear. Then have you ever wondered what lurked beneath the surface of oceans, rivers, and streams during the age of dinosaurs? Paleontologists from the Natural History Museum talk about an upcoming event that will uncover these little known dinosaurs. All of that coming up on Cool Science Radio, of course, heard every Thursday after the local news hour at 9 o'clock. Taking a look at some local news now, Sundance Film Festival director Eugene Hernandez says that the Institute has not made a decision about a possible relocation. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
At a press conference Wednesday to mark the start of the 2025 Sundance Film Festival, event director Eugene Hernandez said the nonprofit is still evaluating a potential move to Boulder, Colorado or Cincinnati, Ohio.
The answer is no, not yet. Look, nearly a year ago, we announced the launch of an RFP process to find a new home for the Sundance Film Festival. Our work continues, and we still have 2 more years anchored here in Park City. Later this winter or early in the spring, once we complete our work on this RFP, we'll announce the new home of the Sundance Film Festival.
Sundance announced in April 2024 it was considering a move, citing financial pressures and a lack of accessibility in Park City, which has been the event's home for over 40 years. Hernandez said the Sundance Institute is focused on the experience in Park City and Salt Lake City for this year's festival, which garnered over 16,000 film submissions. But the excitement of opening another year of the festival was a bit muted as Sundance leaders expressed their sadness and concern over the devastating wildfires in Los Angeles. Sundance acting CEO Amanda Kelso said Wednesday, their thoughts are with everyone who has been impacted.
It's been a really devastating reminder of how fragile everything can be. I love Los Angeles, and my heart weighs really heavy with all the folks who have been impacted, including people who are part of our community here, but also it impacts everybody who lives in Southern California. So it's been a really immeasurable loss.
Kelso said she hopes the festival can provide people a chance to move forward and heal. Sundance Director of Programming Kim Utani also spoke Wednesday, highlighting a few filmmakers who she thinks will make waves at the 2025 festival.
So I want you to keep a special eye out for James Sweeney in Twinless, Katarina Zhu, she made the film Bunny Lover, Ava Victor in Sorry Baby, Pascual Gutierrez in Serious People, Grace Glowicki in Dead Lover, and Shireen Dibas in All That's Left of You. You know, these people are clearly show-offs.
The Sundance Film Festival kicks off with screenings in Park City Thursday and runs through Sunday, February 2nd. More information about the event, including tickets, parking, and transportation, can be found online at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
The Summit County Council met yesterday, and in studio with a recap of the meeting, I have Councilmember Megan McKenna. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this was what, your second meeting?
Third meeting.
So how's it going? You got a lot to learn?
A lot to learn. That's right. It's been great. It's several people have said it's like drinking from a fire hose your first year, and it feels pretty accurate. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. The council interviewed several candidates for 2 vacancies on the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission after Thomas Cook and Chris Connaby resigned. So what are you looking for in a new planning commissioner?
Yeah, that's a great question. We actually did appoint 2 new members to the Planning Commission last night. There were 9 applicants. And I think what we really look for is someone that's engaged in the community, that's familiar with the local issues, with land use, and someone that has the time and commitment to spend on the Planning Commission.
So the council did appoint Tim Jeffrey and Spencer Young to the Planning Commission. What stood out to you about those two?
I think, you know, really, we had several really excellent applicants. It was a tough decision, but I think what stood out most with the two of them was their history in the community and their background. Tim has served with the Park City School District for almost 30 years. He teaches AP human geography, which looks at a lot of urban planning, and so we were really excited for what he can bring, and Spencer as well. He's been an active member on the Board of Adjustments, looking to expand his service in the community. So we're really excited to bring both of them on board.
So many of the applicants sounds like they had participated in the community planning lab. You and I both were in that inaugural class. Has that become a jumping off point or a feeder program for people who you think are interested in public service?
Yeah, it seems that way, and that's really exciting. And I think that was, you know, part of the idea that it would engage people in the process. And yeah, we've seen a lot of interest because of it. The Planning Lab is actually open right now through Monday, the 27th. They're recruiting for the upcoming class. So I'd recommend to anyone that's interested in learning more about the planning process in our local land use issues to apply to the Community Planning Lab by Monday.
Okay. There are some restrictions about how many planning commissioners can live within the Park City limits. What is that? And did that affect some of your decisions and who to appoint?
No, that wasn't a factor in this decision. Both of the applicants live in the Snyderville Basin, but you can have two applicants from the Park City area.
Two sitting commissioners.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Turning to the state legislature, lawmakers have introduced a bill that would require a housing density overlay. So in plain English, it sounds like the county may need to change its zoning.
It may need to, and you know, at this stage, the legislative session just started on Tuesday, so it's still pretty early. But yeah, that is a possibility.
Okay, so my understanding from County Attorney Dave Thomas that this bill would allow for 8 units per acre for deed-restricted affordable housing in every residential zone in the state. My question, does that include the estate zone? I mean, that is a residential zone, and that allows like one unit per 20 or 40 acres.
Yeah, and it sounds like we're still unclear exactly how that would impact us here in the county, but definitely something that we're going to be watching.
Okay, so if approved, any idea when it would go into effect?
I don't know that.
Okay. And in terms of building 8 units per acre of affordable housing in Summit County. I mean, is that profitable? I mean, somebody coming from the affordable housing segment there, I mean, it would really only affect things if developers thought they could turn a profit on that kind of development.
Yeah, I think it depends, you know, where the density is. I think that's always the critical factor there. I think it could help with affordability, and I think I think that's the intention, but I think oftentimes there's unintended consequences, and so yeah, I think again it's one that we just need to watch and see how it will impact us locally.
So under the bill, would the county maintain its aesthetic controls, things like setbacks, height limits, things like that?
As far as I know, that, yeah, we would still have land use control over those.
All right, there's another bill in the works that would shift the population limits that classify Utah counties. What that means is that Summit County is currently a third class county based on our population. This new bill would make Summit County a fourth class county. So why is this a big deal?
Again, this is another one that we're not really, we're not entirely sure how this will impact us and still looking at it. There are several carve-outs and things that have been grandfathered into the county based on our classification. And so that's really our concern and why we're watching this right now. So for example, inclusionary zoning is something that has been grandfathered in. And so we're concerned if our classification moves, would those no longer be grandfathered? Or would those carve-outs for third class counties no longer apply? And so I think there's still a lot to learn from this one, and I think a lot of counties are watching it and are concerned. But in addition, is, you know, potentially there could be new legislation that could impact us as a fourth class county. So certainly something that we'll want to watch. You know, like anything, there's going to be pros and cons to either. And so it's just a matter of weighing those. And at this time, I think it's the county's perspective that remaining class three would probably still be more beneficial than changing.
Hmm. So at this point, we don't know what we would lose out in terms of benefit-wise going to be named a fourth class county.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. What about any bills that lobbyists and staff trying to write? Would they try and designate Summit County as a third or a fourth class? Would you prefer? Sounds like the staff would prefer to stay as third class.
I think from what we know from that at this point, that's true. But as Candace Hart mentioned last night, are there potential benefits to becoming a fourth class that we're not aware of yet? And so those are things to be weighed.
All right. The council heard a request from a Rockport area resident to give up a public road. He says it's a dead end to his home, some 350 feet up the road, but people frequently drive down it by accident trying to get to the Rockport State Park. He didn't make a decision last night, but did signal support. So do you see any reason to deny the request?
Not at this time. We did hold a public hearing, and there were no comments, and so we'll see if we hear anything in the meantime. But the only access currently to that road is to the private residents and to Mountain Regional Water. And they are both in favor of the road vacation for the reason you listed. If you haven't been out there, it's the southeast corner of Rockport. There's no public access on that road. And so really it just creates more issues with people thinking that there's access to the state park there and then having to turn around. And if there's boats and trailers, it causes issues.
Yeah. So does it get plowed by the county? I mean, would this person be liable then for clearing the road to his house?
Yeah. And they currently maintain that road already. There's no public uses on the road. And so that would remain the same. So we did support the petition. And so the next step is they'll come back with an ordinance. And if we don't hear anything, I don't see any reason why that wouldn't pass.
All right. Let's see. Residents continue to gather signatures to put the council's December vote approving the Dakota Pacific Real Estate's amendment to the development agreement in Kimball Junction on this November's ballot. And I guess we should correct that right now because there was some reporting done that it was going to be 2026. But it's actually this year's election if, in fact, they are successful. You didn't vote on that because you weren't in office at that point. But you have had the opportunity as a council to weigh in with a statement on the voter information packet that has been released. Any idea why the county didn't submit a statement?
Yeah, that was unfortunate. We actually didn't learn about that until it was too late. And I think all of us would have appreciated the opportunity to provide a statement. And so that's really on us now individually to go out and to try to inform the public on where we stand on that. And I certainly support the council's vote. While I wasn't in office at the time, as you mentioned, I do support their decision to support the amended agreement, and I will not be signing the referendum.
Hmm. So why do you support the project?
I support the project because I think what the council was able to negotiate is a much better agreement. I think the community benefit is much greater than the original development agreement. I've heard and I've had the benefit this past year of talking to residents across the county in the campaign about this issue. And so I've heard from several and I think the community benefit of mixed use far outweighs the exclusionary zoning in the original agreement. I've heard many say, build what you bought. And I counter that with, I think we should ask the developer to build better than they bought. And I think that's what this amended development agreement is. I think it's better than the original.
Are you aware of any legislative bills pertaining to this development in the works, or have any been introduced that you're aware of?
Not at this time, but I think, you know, we're certainly expecting there to be a legislative response. As you know, at the legislation passed last year with incorporation, that is one of the options that the developer is seeking.
Yeah, that's Senate Bill 258. So they may be just satisfied with what that gives them, the ability to incorporate.
Yeah, and I think that was the concern of the council. And for those that aren't as familiar with that decision or are confused to why the council voted the way they did, I would recommend going back to that December 18th council meeting. I think each council member really gave a really good description of why they voted the way they did. And I think they made it really clear that they were concerned about legislation. If it wasn't passed, that would be retaliatory in nature or take away our current land use authority here locally in Summit County.
Okay, anything else you wanna mention?
You know, I would just encourage everyone to know before you sign and make an informed decision. The referendum certainly will impact the future of Summit County and our land use authority. So I would take that seriously. And there's a lot of misinformation out there and a lot of confusion. So if you're not sure, go back and look at that amended agreement. Reach out to your counselors. There's been excellent coverage since the decision was made. So I would just encourage those to make an informed decision. And
Okay. Megan, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
That's Summit County Councilmember Megan McKenna. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Park City Board of Education met Tuesday, and in the studio with me, with a meeting recap, I have the president of the board, Meredith Reed, along with the vice chair, Nick Hill. Thanks for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's start with the news from yesterday that federal immigration officers can detain migrants who do not have legal status in areas previously considered sensitive, like our schools. There was a message from Interim Superintendent Caleb Fye that went out to parents yesterday. The copy I saw was in English. I just want to make sure that went out in Spanish as well.
We actually have not confirmed that, so we will make sure it does go today. Yes. I think
if it hasn't, it certainly will.
It was an oversight, so we will make sure that it does. That is very important information, and we particularly want our Spanish-speaking community members to be aware of it.
Sure, it probably impacts them the most. Any concerns so far that you've heard from parents about this?
I think at this point, it's just the generalized anxiety around this announcement, and with the incoming administration, whatever that might look like. I think there's just a lot of uncertainty and fear, you know, there is, but I haven't heard specific. It's just sort of this unease around all of these things.
Yeah, and do we have any idea how this might work if, in fact, federal officers did come to our schools? Do they just walk in and demand to see paperwork ensuring that all staff and students are there legally?
Yeah, well, I think that it's important to note that we don't collect information on immigration status. So if they do come to a school, we wouldn't have that information anyway. And at this stage, we're trying to understand the impact of that and how we can best support our vulnerable communities.
So. Yeah, so how does this information come? Do you have any idea? I mean, was just an email to the superintendent of every school in the country?
I'm not sure how it got communicated or if it was even directly communicated to each school district. I don't know that at all.
I'm not sure it was anything beyond the executive orders that went out.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. Your first meeting with a brand new board, any sense in how you guys are all going to work together?
Well, it was actually our second.
It's January. Okay.
We had a board retreat the week before, which is also a public meeting. Now, it wasn't something that, I mean, anybody who was interested or wanted to come certainly could have, but it was more an opportunity for the new board members and all of us to be together, sort of level setting around some of the important things that everybody needs to know about budget, legal concerns, high level overview from our attorney. We also talked to our local law enforcement partners who, again, going back to if something does happen with that activity around, we would expect to be in partnership with our police and sheriff. And then we also went over our survey results at the retreat. And then so Tuesday was our first official board meeting. So.
All right, so at the retreat, I mean, did you spend time there then prioritizing goals for the coming year?
Not yet. That's actually going to come in a second part. We have that scheduled for mid-February. We're excited to get to that, right? And that will be a more strategic session where we really do talk about vision and we talk about our goals and just set the expectations for the coming year.
And communicate those with our community as well. Yeah. You know, let folks know what we hope to accomplish as a board, what we're looking forward for the district.
Of course, yeah.
All right, let's look at some of the legislative issues. House Bill 267 was mentioned, I guess, during the meeting. This bill would affect education support professional wages when they are already the lowest paid employees in most school districts. So what are we talking about here? Did you get some understanding on that?
I will be honest, it's a challenge to keep up with all of the bills that come out of the legislature. I thought we just talked about the union one, that maybe it's the same. I mean, there's a lot of things that it covers, actually.
I think it is, that one. Every year there is a volume of bills that come out during the legislative session, and it is very difficult for all school districts to react to that. You know, through the session, we'll be paying close attention and seeing what will impact us. And then the reality is, in a school district, we spend the next year trying to react to what the legislature has put in place.
Yeah, seems like that's where a lot of policy changes come, because things have changed.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But that particular bill, I will be honest, is a concern. I mean, it is a pretty direct attack on our staff and their ability to collectively work with us, and we'll be paying very close attention to it.
All right. We also just heard about Senate Bill 102. My understanding is this would eliminate funding for dual immersion programs. I guess if the state cuts funding for it, is it something that Park City would continue to offer? Because as I recall, we started this before there was even any funding for it from the state.
So apparently it doesn't directly eliminate the funding, but it says that if the program's eliminated, so then it would sunset the funds that would go into that account. I think we're not planning on sunsetting any dual language programs.
Our DLI programs are hugely successful and very valuable. I mean, again, at this stage, I think a lot of what comes from the legislature is noise, and obviously we pay very close attention. The impacts of something like that, as Meredith said, our understanding right now is it wouldn't actually pull funding. If something was passed that did pull funding, obviously we would look at how to best handle that going forward.
Yeah, because I think what we've got now, we've got all grades covered, 1 through 8, right, with dual language.
Yes, 1 through 8, 1 through 9.
High school now, they have their own English classes. I think any other legislative issues that you wanted to highlight?
That we appreciate the efforts of the Joint Legislative Committee between the Utah School Boards Association and the Superintendents Association. This is kind of a full-time job for some of the folks to just keep up with the pace, and just that we already always appreciate it when our lawmakers consult with folks who are in education. It makes it a much smoother process.
Okay. The school board also got an update on the phone pouch program at Treasure Mountain Junior High. The principal there mentioned that there have been fewer suspensions compared to last year after using the pouches to lock phones away. I mean, how is the district correlating no phones to fewer suspensions? Or is that correlation?
I don't know that they're necessarily finding a direct correlation. It's more that they're experiencing a lot of conflict can arise starting on social media and starting on the phones. And when we've kind of taken that out, that distraction, that ongoing activity during class, or being able to respond immediately to whatever, you know, insults or something that someone doesn't like, then that kind of diffuses it without the phones there.
Sure. So any other factors that may have contributed to the decrease in suspensions?
I just think that there it's a positive note that this is going down, and you know, keep looking at other ways, you know, ways to continue that trend and make sure that kids are resolving their differences constructively.
All right, so we won't have a Treasure Mountain Junior High next year. So will that policy then be put into the Ecker campus, and are we going to start something similar in the high school?
I can say I think if it's successful at Treasure, we would look at transferring that to Ecker. I'm not sure about the high school.
Okay. Yeah, I think certainly we need to look generally at cell phone use in schools. I will acknowledge also that those pouches are not necessarily popular with the kids in the schools right now. But to the extent that it is helping affect some positive behavioral change, I think that's a good thing, and we need to consider how they can productively be used going forward.
Okay. I want to follow up on the email that Michelle Deininger sent to school district leaders, as well as the media this week. 2 months ago, former school board member Andrew Kaplan assured KBCW listeners that her reporting that she had done in the Park Record about the fact that the school district has the highest paid COO in the state, who is also drawing a salary for CEO but being paid on a separate contract for special assignment duty as a district security director, was inaccurate, he told us. Kaplan said that he would be following up and we'd hear about it, and I haven't heard anything. So was the reporting accurate? Are there any corrections that need to be made to the report?
At this point, we have started an independent investigation into the allegations and the issues that were raised in that report. And so once that's concluded, we can go forward from there.
All right. Well, according to Transparent Utah, and this is the online state, I mean, you can look at any state, county, city employee and see what they earn. Mr. Tanner's salary and benefits are $394,000 a year, again, as we mentioned, the highest in Utah. As Michelle's email noted to you this week, the amount provided by the school district employees differ by about $50,000. So do we have a number? I mean, what is he being paid?
Yeah, again, Leslie, we certainly appreciate the legitimate interest in this, but we have an independent investigation right now into all of the claims made in that article and following from that article, and we really can't comment until we have that investigation finalized.
All right, who's doing the investigation? I mean, law enforcement? Or
no, there's two parts to this. So an HR director from another district, so it's somebody outside of the school district, and then there's some issues around the military service, so we have somebody from a retired brigadier general who's helping with that part.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about that, the military part of it, because I guess you had heard from a school district employee who alleges that he was doing work outside of the school district, but getting military leave from it. So at this point, you're telling me you don't know until the investigation is complete?
Correct. I mean, we're letting them do all, you know, ask all the questions, look at all the documents, see everything that they need to see in order to answer these questions.
They have full access to everything to get to the truth, and we will comment once we have detail on that investigation.
So any idea when the status of this investigation is expected, when you're going to hear something?
Yeah, I'm not going to put a firm timeline on it. It depends to some extent, you know, how that investigation develops, but we're hoping that we'll have something next month.
So I guess if in fact you find that there was some inaccuracies in the reporting, do you file charges against the record or the reporter?
I think we would just address it with a conversation would be a good place to start, but I think we'll just have to see again what the next best steps are. I don't know that we're anxious to pursue legal action.
All right. I also want to point out that you've heard from a district employee who alleges that not only has Mr. Tanner stored his private vehicle in the district's maintenance building, but has also had district mechanics services vehicle while he's been working remotely. Has that been verified?
That's part of the investigation, so.
Okay. So what is the status of Mike Tanner's employment? At this point, he's on the job?
Yes.
All right. Let's see. There was also a discussion at the board meeting on the We All Belong Kindness Awards. These are not only monthly awards, but a pretty nice annual grand prize for both staff and students. Tell us a little bit more about this and why you felt like you needed to offer money for good behavior.
I think that was an added benefit that came in from the Community Foundation so that they had that extra carrot with that program. You know, we're just looking for a way to foster a culture in our community, in our schools, of caring for each other, being respectful for each other, valuing each other, you know, not harassing, not bullying, and really just, you know, having a place where kids are welcome and feel like they belong. I mean, it's a little, we all belong is a slogan, but it's important that learning doesn't get accomplished if children are scared or children are anxious or children are feeling like the people around them don't value their well-being. So this is a really an integral part to making sure that our kids can achieve the best that they can.
So the monthly award, the annual award, my understanding is that the an educator would be awarded a $2,500 $1,000 and a $2,500 scholarship for the students. So what about the monthly awards?
I think maybe the monthly awards are just a recognition, and then those people would be then put forward for the annual.
All right, got it. So what kind of behavior, I guess, would warrant being recognized?
I think that's up to the kids and the teachers, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we talked about this a little bit in the meeting on Tuesday, and I think it's really about things that go above and beyond. It's not just about someone showing some basic respect to someone in a hallway or something. It's really about showing some demonstrable action that that makes a difference. And as you know, I think this is. This is part of, as Meredith said, fostering a culture, right? We are well aware that, you know, we had the OCR findings. We had numerous issues in our school district that need to be addressed. And this is just one of many components, I think, over the coming months and years in terms of how we foster the right culture in our schools and how we sort of embed the behaviors that we want to see in the district.
All right, I think you also got an update with regard to the athletic master plan. Can you give us an idea of where things stand there? I mean, are we going to see the demolition of Treasure Mountain this year, or?
That is the plan, yeah. We are looking to move forward as soon as the weather permits us to do that, and hopefully we will have new facilities in place within the next year is the target, and that's really important in getting our kids access to the activities that we support through athletics. So you know it's exciting to see those new facilities come online.
Yeah, and I also saw in some notes that. The school district has commissioned a comprehensive traffic study to evaluate the Kearns campus traffic improvements. Is that underway at this point?
I'm not sure what the status is with that. I know that we have heard from neighbors behind the high school, you know, with concerns about how traffic gets routed, how the buses go. I mean, it's certainly something that we need to look at and how it impacts the area where the school is. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure what the status is on that.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, just that we really appreciate everybody. I say no, but yes, we really appreciate everybody who participated in our survey that we sent out to the community regarding priorities around what we're looking for in the next superintendent and what we want to accomplish with our district. And so we got a really good response from that, well over 1,000 people. Yeah, it was impressive.
Yeah, so thrilled with the response to that and really important feedback. So thank you, everyone, who participated in that.
So has the job been posted at this point? Are you kind of reviewing the survey results before you kind of put together the job description?
We've got some different avenues available to us for hiring, so we're discussing that as a board.
Okay, so at this point, it's not posted.
It is not.
Yeah,
no.
And the plan is that Caleb Fine would probably just serve to the end of the school year?
He'll serve as long as we need an interim.
Okay. All right. Nick Hill, Meredith Reed, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
The Swanner Preserve and Eco Center has a new exhibit up. In the studio with details, I have Hunter Klingensmith, the Director of Visitor Experience and Exhibits. Good morning, Hunter.
Good morning, Leslie.
The exhibit is titled Amazing Butterflies. I was thinking this seems a bit odd since we only see butterflies in the summer, but this is actually, apparently somebody told me, this is when all of the monarch butterflies congregate in the hills above Mexico City.
Yeah.
So it's like a happening somewhere in the world.
Yeah, it's a happening somewhere in the world. We also run into, just with exhibit timing, in the summertime, we use the space where the exhibits are for camps. So those are actually the classroom spaces. So we can only host exhibits in the fall and the spring. And this is kind of our spring season, even though I know we're in winter right now. But I've been looking at this exhibit for a while. We found that we had an exhibit a few years ago that was mini golf, and it was all about environmental themes. And people just really loved that interactive element, and especially in the winter, something to do with your kids that's not outside when it's 8 degrees like it is today. And so this exhibit is a maze. It's actually, you start as the egg of the butterfly, and then you go all the way through the life cycle, and at the end you kind of emerge. So you're facing challenges along the way to help you learn which direction to go. There are some really fun interactives in the maze, and you get a little fun stamp card on your way through where that kind of tracks your journey as you go through the maze.
Yeah, so what are some of the interesting facts that people will learn about butterflies as they make their way through the maze?
Yeah, there's some really fun things about, you're going to learn about how they emerge from their chrysalises, how long it takes for them to go through that process. One fun fact that I love is that their eyes, they actually have like 6,000 little individual eyes, and they can see ultraviolet light, which is something that we can't see, right? So if you look at pictures of flowers with ultraviolet light, it's actually a way for bees can see this, butterflies can see this ultraviolet light, and it's a way for them to better see flowers and find the nectar that they're looking for. So that's one of my fun facts from the exhibit.
Yeah, so do you have any live butterflies in there? Or?
No live butterflies. Mm-hmm. That has been kind of the going question. Although we are encouraging people to come see our exhibit and then maybe take some time to go to the butterfly biosphere at Thanksgiving Point, because they do have live butterflies there. We just don't really have space to have live butterflies, but the butterfly biosphere at Thanksgiving Point is a really cool spot to do that and a great combo with this exhibit.
Yeah. How long do butterflies even live?
That's a great question that I don't actually know the answer to, Leslie.
Okay.
I should have come prepared with that one.
So the exhibit is on display. You opened it just a few days ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. We opened it on Saturday. We actually had a free day as the first day, and it was a big hit. We had a ton of families, and everyone was having a great time. We've also added some local interactives about Utah butterflies, so you can learn a little bit about the symmetry of butterflies' wings. There's a chance to look up close with a microscope and a some magnifying glasses at butterflies, and then some information about local Utah butterflies, and then other resources about how you can get involved in butterfly conservation or go to see some of these other butterfly learning opportunities.
Yeah, so are we aware of any kind of the demise of the butterfly like we saw with the honeybee?
We know that monarch butterflies are on decline, and a lot of that is habitat loss. You asked me about how the lifespan of butterflies, and with monarchs, they have a really interesting, I'm not going to go into the depth of it because I don't know exactly all of the details, but they actually have many generations that make that migration to Mexico. So there are some that live much shorter lives and some that live much longer lives. Like once they're there overwintering, that's one generation. But in that migration, they actually have multiple generations that make that trek. And so as we see loss of habitat for butterflies, that can be really challenging. And we're seeing that with our local native species, other native species as well. So basically insect biodiversity overall has been decreasing. So it's something that we want to make sure that people know about the importance of butterflies and the impact that they have on our ecosystems. They're important pollinators, and they play a role in that whole ecosystem. So yeah.
All right, there is a charge for the exhibit.
Yep, it's $7 per person. That's from ages 3 to 64 years, and then we have a senior discount of $1, or anyone with a valid military ID is $6. Kiddos 0 to 2 are free, and then anyone with a membership to SWANR who's included on that membership gets free access anytime that they'd like to come to the exhibit.
All right, and then you do welcome school field trips.
Yep, we welcome school field trips. We had one earlier this week, and we have another one today, so we're filling up with that, so if anyone's interested, reach out to Catherine on our team.
Okay. Let's see.
So there's a few free days with the exhibit. We want to make sure that cost is not a barrier to everyone or to anyone who wants to see the exhibit. So there are a few free days. The next one will be Thursday, February 20th. We have one Friday, March 14th, and another one Sunday, April 13th. And then also, if you feel like that cost doesn't work for you, you can go onto our website and request a free ticket to the exhibit. And then it's also in the whole exhibit is in available in Spanish as well.
Great. Tell me what else you got going on during the winter months. I know you were doing snowshoe tours.
Yep, we've got our regular Saturday morning snowshoe tours. We're a little low on snow on the preserve, but we're still going out on snowshoes. Hopefully we'll get some more soon. Those are at 9:30 every Saturday morning. We also offer private guided tours on the preserve on snowshoes. So if you'd like to get out and do that, you can just submit a request on our website. And then you can also just rent snowshoes at the Eco Center, either to take out onto the preserve or to take anywhere around town that you'd like. We also, on February 11th, are doing nature trivia at Park City Brewing, and that should be always a fun time to get out there and learn a little bit more about our local nature. I'm sure we'll have a butterfly section in there, too, so if you want some more butterfly fun facts, that's a good time to come for that. And then we are doing some moonlight snowshoe tours. Our February one is actually already full. They fill up very quickly, but we'll be doing another one on March 13th, and if you sign up for our newsletter, you can kind of get the first idea of when that registration will open for those. And then it's almost time for summer camp sign up, which is wild. And so just a reminder for anyone who's planning to sign up for summer camps at SWANR, you need to renew or join your membership if you want early access by Friday, February 28th at 5 p.m. And so Sand Hill Society members, which is donors of $1,000 or more, get early access starting on March 14th to sign up, and then everyone else, we're looking at March 17th and then March for family members, and then March 19th is the general sign up at 9 a.m. So we recommend getting on. It fills up fast.
Okay, and you're also offering a kind of the winter break school summer camp. Is that still available?
Ski break camp, I think, still does have some spaces. So you can find that on our website to sign up. And it's you sign up by day for that one. So you can pick one day or all of the days.
Okay. Let's see. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, we've been seeing some fun wildlife out there. We saw what we think were some bobcat tracks the other day. So exciting things. And the elk have been out pretty regularly. So come visit us anytime. Even though we have the exhibit going on and there is an entry fee, the Eco Center is open for free to the public as per usual. You can go out onto the back deck, go out to the Wetland Discovery Trail, or hang out in the Naturalist Room, and that's all still free.
Yeah, I was reporting earlier this week, somebody called me in and said, hey, the elk are trying to move from basically the SWANR side to the kind of the Bittner Road side.
Oh, yeah.
So they don't hang out in the preserve. They move that?
Elk migrate pretty regularly. They usually come down into this basin area in the winter because it's a lot easier to access food. But they are moving within that time. Sometimes we'll see them for 3 weeks and they kind of hang out in the same zone. But if they're not finding the food that they want or they're not happy in the space that they are, then they will move. And elk will go pretty far. I don't know the range off the top of their head, but they move pretty far within their yearly cycle of migration. So
it's kind of a day-to-day thing, whether or not you have elk on the preserve, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what people always come in and say, like, what wildlife will we see? And it's kind of unpredictable, right? We can guess that you're more than likely to see a cottontail rabbit. There's one that's been hanging out outside of the windows almost every day. But this time of year, we might see 25 bull elk, or you might not see anything and just see some tracks. But I love winter because even if you can't see the wildlife, the evidence of them in their tracks and their scat is so abundant. And so that's what we talk a lot about on those snowshoe tours, is we'll do a bunch of tracking of what wildlife we are seeing.
Okay. Hunter, thanks so much.
Awesome. Thanks, Leslie.
Again, people can get more information by going to SWANRecocenter.org. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has announced that it will permit federal immigration officers to detain migrants who do not have legal status in areas previously considered sensitive, like our schools. KPCW's Christine Muller has the Park City School District's response.
On January 20th, the Department of Homeland Security rescinded the Biden administration's guidelines prohibiting arrests by U.S. immigration agents at or near sensitive areas. Those included schools, places of worship, healthcare facilities, shelters, relief centers, and public demonstrations like rallies and protests. The Park City School District Wednesday addressed the community's concerns about the changes. In a statement, Interim Superintendent Caleb Fine assured residents that every child, regardless of immigration status, is welcome in Park City schools. He said the district does not collect data on the immigration status of students or their family members, and therefore cannot provide it to law enforcement. Fine said the district will not initiate contact with federal immigration authorities to share student information. Fine said counselors are available at all Park City schools to assist students who are feeling stressed or fearful with the recent changes. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. I'm Leslie Thatcher.